This is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe
on ABC Radio Hobart and across Tasmania.
G'day, welcome to the Country Hour. Coming up today, record lamb prices tip to continue as countries like the US show strong demand for lamb.
It depends on the margins through the supply chain, but looking at, say, a US import price going into, well, Australian product going into the US, they're importing product about $18 a kilo. We're selling lambs at $7 a kilo, so there's a bit of margin that's grown out in the last year and a half in that market. So despite us getting some really good prices, you know, the US market is still performing very strongly.
And what to do about the large number of plastic punnets used in the berry industry?
It's a lot of plastic, yeah. For us, it's concerning, and I think the industry as a whole is quite concerned by it and is working towards how we can, you know, work with our customers as well to address this as a sort of industry as a whole.
A story coming up shortly, but first, in the latest move in the US-China trade war, the American government has announced it will spend $12 billion to help farmers cope with huge tariff increases. And it likely will have a flow-on effect for Australian farmers, as Nikolai Baylarts reports.
The Trump administration has announced the $12 billion fund in response to Chinese tariff increases on crops like soybeans, but also in an effort to shore up support in the US Midwest, where many farmers voted for Donald Trump. Under the new plan, the US government will provide direct financial assistance to farmers, as well as doing things like buying up excess crops and then putting them into low-income food assistance programs. US lobby group, the National Farmers Union, says the government there needs to do more to provide a long-term fix. The NFU's president is Roger Johnson.
Market prices for farm products are plunging from already very low levels, and it's been estimated that farmers lost more than $13 billion last month alone due to these trade disruptions. While we appreciate the move to provide stopgap assistance, this plan is a short-term fix to a long-term problem. The administration must develop a support mechanism that will mitigate the significant damage that is being inflicted upon our most vital international markets for many years to come. They should do this by working with Congress to ensure that Farm Bill programs provide enough assistance to farmers when markets collapse.
So what effect will this latest move have in Australia? Stephen Kirshner is Trade and Investment Director with the United States Study Centre in Sydney. He says it will have an effect, but it's a bit unclear yet how that will play out.
Well, there are two effects there. So on the one hand, Chinese demand is going to be directed to other markets at the expense of the US because Chinese importers won't want to pay the retaliatory tariffs on their imports. And so there may be some scope for Australian producers to pick up some of that demand. On the other hand, of course, you've got American exports that were previously going to China likely being diverted into other markets as well. So it's not clear what the net effect of that is going to be. The main implication here, of course, is that just the usual business as usual is going to be disrupted by this. And so Australian producers may find that they're facing new competition in some of their markets.
Stephen Kirshner also says this is a clear indication that Donald Trump is digging in when it comes to imposing tariffs.
This is a classic case of protectionism breeding more protectionism. So you had the US tariffs being imposed on China. China naturally retaliated to those tariffs being imposed, and those tariffs have been very much targeted at the Midwest agricultural states that are politically sensitive for Donald Trump. U.S. farmers are hurting from this, and it's no surprise that the administration is trying to support them.
Now, in response already, the National Farmers Union in the U.S. has said that essentially this is welcome, but that it is just a short-term prop-up. Do they have a point with that argument?
Well, I think it's a short-term solution to what's going to be a long-term problem because there's no indication that the tariff war between the United States and the rest of the world is going to get any better. In fact, I think it could get a lot worse. And to the extent that other countries continue to retaliate against US tariffs, then I think US agricultural producers in particular are going to find themselves very exposed and very vulnerable. And I don't think $12 billion will get them very far in an environment where US agricultural exports to the rest of the world are being targeted in this way.
Which is remarkable, isn't it, when you just hear the figure $12 billion and you think that sounds like so much money, but that it might not have that significant an impact.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you look at US exports of soybeans, for example, to the US, that's a $14 billion market. And a lot of the Chinese demand for soybeans is going to be diverted to other countries. So just in that market alone, I think the US is very exposed.
And you've touched on this previously, but what do you think this announcement says about Donald Trump's and the Trump administration's attitude towards tariffs? Is this basically them saying, we're digging in?
I think they are. There's a school of thought which says that what Trump is doing is a clever negotiating tactic designed to get other countries to lower their trade barriers. But to get any sort of negotiated outcome here, you have to have some trade talks in progress, and that's simply not happening. The US and China are really not talking at a senior level. The US isn't talking to Canada and Mexico in any meaningful way at this time. And so I think we have to be very pessimistic about where this goes. I don't think we come down from here anytime soon. I think what happens is we have an escalating tariff war between the United States on the one hand, China, the EU, Canada and Mexico on the other.
Stephen Kirshner, Program Director of Trade and Investment with the United States Study Centre at the University of Sydney. Well, meanwhile, in a slightly different take on the trade war, and an interesting example of how agricultural trade barriers are making it into the mainstream, China's state-run and owned overseas broadcaster, CGTN, has produced a video about soybeans, which features a cheery cartoon soybean that talks about the US trade war. But in that video, it does include a not-too-subtle veiled threat.
Hi, everybody. I am a soybean. I may not look like much, but I'm very important. I've been in the news lately because I'm caught in the middle of a trade war involving the two powerful countries of China and the United States. U.S. President Donald Trump has imposed tariffs on billions of dollars worth of Chinese imports. In return, China has done the same, levying taxes on many products from the U.S., and one of them is, you guessed it, soybeans. You see, China is the world's largest consumer of soybeans. In fact, it imports 85% of the crop. More expensive soy can mean that China will look to other sources for the bulk of its imports. As two of the top soybean suppliers to China, Brazil and Argentina could pick up the slack. If that happens, soybean farmers in the US could take an even greater hit.
That's an animated soybean featured on China's overseas state broadcasting TV channel, ending that report from Nikolai Bailarts. Coming up in the Country Hour, what to do about the large amount of plastic punnets used in the berry industry. To the lamb industry now, and a meat analyst says the record lamb prices being seen in Australian sale yards may yet go even higher. Animal protein analyst with Rabobank, Angus Gidley-Baird, says traditionally winter lamb prices are higher, but he told Sally Dacus that given growing demand in the US, Australia's largest single lamb market, prices may have yet to peak.
I think definitely if you're a sheep producer, you're probably pretty happy at the moment. I mean, there is, in large parts of eastern Australia, particularly New South Wales, from very dry conditions that would have an impact on your ability to actually run those sheep at the moment. But the prices are phenomenal in terms of lamb prices. So, yeah, very good lamb prices at the moment.
It is winter, and it's when people have to pay a lot to get their stock into this sort of condition. But do you think it's going to last long, or do you think it's just a winter thing?
No, well, the seasonality that we used to see in those lamb prices has tended to flatten itself out over the last couple of years. So usually you would have the peak season in winter in terms of price. The price will be at its highest during winter because that's when supply is lower, and then the price tends to fall from July, August, all the way through to November when they have the new flush of lambs come into the market. But it's tended to flatten itself out, and it's stayed pretty strong. So I think, and you look at the export markets, which are really driving these prices, those prices are still firm. So I think there's a lot of positive news and potentially some upside with the prices still.
You're kidding me. Really?
No, and it's unfortunate for the Australian consumer if you're out trying to buy lamb, but at the moment the US market is paying some very high prices for lamb.
And can you give us some idea of how much upside?
Well, it depends on the margins through the supply chain, but looking at, say, a US import price going into, well, Australian product going into the US, they're importing product about $18 a kilo. We're selling lambs at $7 a kilo, so there's a bit of margin that's grown out in the last year and a half in that market. So despite us getting some really good prices, you know, the US market is still performing very strongly.
So just clarify that the US are paying $18 a kilo. So that's a wholesale price? Is that right?
That's the US imported lamb price from Australia.
Okay,
so they're buying Australian lamb.
If I was in America and I was going to sit down to a meal of lamb or went to the supermarket as a consumer, what would I expect to pay for Australian lamb?
The retail price, and again, I got the caveat on this is that the information or the data we've got is based on online sales prices, so it doesn't necessarily reflect the actual retail price. But around $21-$22 a kilo is about the retail price on average from that data. So it's more expensive than Australia. That's Australian dollar terms, sorry, not US.
So you would think that Australians will need to get used to paying more for Australian lamb?
Yes, and I think this is the interesting thing from a producer point of view. To me, lamb has really done a wonderful job in creating a premium tag with it. So whereas probably you and I, without showing our age, used to have lamb on our plate quite regularly and it was a fairly common staple from a protein point of view, it's now moved into much more premium position. And I know family, friends of mine that will be willing to go and pay, you know, $30-$35 a kilo for lamb cutlets to give their child a cutlet, because they consider it it's a premium. They're quite happy to pay it. They might not be eating as much, but they're willing to pay higher prices for it. So it's a different consumer.
But in the beef industry, you've got grades of beef. You've got budget, and then you've got MSA grading. But you don't have that in lamb, though, do you?
There is MSA grading for lamb, yes, but it's not as prominent as in beef. And I think that's one of the key things from a lamb perspective. If it's going to move itself, and it has moved itself to this premium side of the market, it really needs to be able to give the producer the information on how to make sure they're producing that premium quality product. So the consumer gets the product, pays the price, is happy with the value that they get and are willing to go and buy it again.
The supermarkets just in the last few weeks have been doing specials on legs of lamb, $10 a kilo or something. There seems to be a little bit of a mismatch, doesn't it, between what's happening in the sale yards and specials in supermarkets?
Yeah, and I don't know how you put the two together, but it's obviously a centre of plate product, though. It's what gets the consumer in to buy, and, you know, if they position lamb as an important part of that meal, then people will purchase that, and obviously the flow-on effects of purchasing other items in the supermarket might be able to offset some of that. And I think, you know, it's probably how they manage some of the supply through the chain. You also got to look at what we're sending to different places too, and Australians tend to eat legs of lamb. We're more traditional eaters. The US might be consuming more racks at the moment. Chinese Middle East might be looking at more four-quarter cuts. So the processor is also shipping it to different markets.
Animal protein analyst with Rabobank, Angus Gidley-Baird, talking there with Sally Dacus. Well, George Gatenby farms in the Campbelltown area. He's measured about the effect of the sky-high lamb prices.
Yes, I'm lucky enough to still be holding on to a few of last season's lambs, and I'm hoping that the prices maintain their great price, just like the wool price is pretty handy at the moment as well. It's never easy to keep lambs through winter, as most of the feed you want to allocate to pregnant ewes as they're going into spring to put lambs in the ground, but the new season lambs, but the industry is in a nice place, and at the same time, we don't need as producers the high levels $8 lamb prices. We'll take it when we can get it. As long as the industry stays sustainable, we're happy.
George Gatenby with a producer's view on the lamb prices. Meanwhile, the middlemen in the meat industry are feeling the pinch. Sharman's Butchery in Wivenhoe near Burnie paying top dollar to keep lamb available. Clint Sharman told Margot Kelly he's noticed the difference at the sale yards.
Yes, certainly. Yeah, especially at the local sale yards. Yeah, we're paying up around $200 per lamb at the moment, which is sort of around the $7 a kilo mark. Yeah.
Which is, how does that compare to what you've normally been spending in this time of the year?
Probably up around 60, 70 cents a kilo. So, yeah, it's up at least 10%. But yeah, lamb is always sort of this time of year at the highest of the highest time of year for lamb, because it's in short supply just before the sucker lambs sort of come on the market.
And how much can you pass on those high prices at the sale yards to your consumers?
Well, at the moment, we're just trying to absorb all the costs that we can. Beef's a little bit cheaper than what it was this time last year. Pork's a little bit cheaper. So, at the moment, we're just trying to refrain from putting our prices up and just see what happens over the next few weeks.
We've spoken to Rabobank analysts who say they reckon the price could still go up, particularly with the dry on the mainland. How much more could you absorb in an operation like this?
Not much. We're sort of we're at the limit now where we any further prices would need to pass it on. Look, and we're seeing up the, I think in Tamworth this week they topped up over $290 per lamb, which is phenomenal, really. But you just got to pass it on at some point, I guess. But sooner we'll just hold off at this stage.
And what's walking out the door right now on a cold, wet, wintry day? What are people buying?
Lamb shanks. Lots of, can't get enough lamb shanks and, a lot of diced lamb for curries and stews and that sort of thing. So, the consumers, they're well aware of the high prices. So, they seem to be happy to pay, and luckily we've got a great product here on the northwest coast, so we're lucky in that way.
How much is lamb now a premium meat?
Very much so. Lamb backstrap is that's the most expensive cut of lamb we sell. That's $43.50 a kilo. I think lamb cutlets are just over around $40 a kilo as well, so it's comparable, I guess. Eye fillet steak in beef, that's the most expensive cut, and that's about $45 a kilo. So it's on par with beef, I guess.
As a local operation, how much do you have your mind on what's happening with that export market as well?
We need to keep an eye on it just so we can be aware of what's going to happen and try and read the play a little bit to see what the prices are going to do in the future, and it's just so we can forecast our pricing and what we need to do going forward.
So you said you source from the sale yards. Is there also a farm that supplies meat to Sharman's Butchery?
Yeah, well, we've got our own farm. At the moment, we don't have any lambs on the farm ready to go, so all of our lamb comes from the Coiber sale yards, which is run by Roberts and then processed at JBS at Devonport. And a lot of our beef comes off our own farm or other farms in the area, which is also sourced from the Coiber sale.
What do you ensure you do to have a point of difference to, say, the supermarkets for a consumer?
We try and have a lot of ready-to-go meals, like different curries, cooked meals. We do a lot of roast meals that are all cooked and just heat and serve. And then we have a lot of other value-added lines and different stir-fries and different gourmet roasts and that sort of thing, just to keep it different.
And how creative do you get?
Oh, very creative. We've got to be try and keep ahead of the supermarkets and that sort of thing, and offer a bit of service where that's where we can be a little bit more agile as opposed to what the supermarkets are offering.
So what's your hot tip for me to take home for a winning meal tonight at the dinner table?
Well, with the weather outside, it'd nearly have to be another lamb shank. There's a lot of lambs running around without any shanks on them at the moment.
That's Clint Sharman, co-owner of Sharman's Butchery in Wivenhoe, just outside Burnie, talking to Margot Kelly about the struggle to keep lamb on the shelves at butcher shops. Now, later in the program, we'll hear from our livestock reporter, Richard Bailey, about the latest lamb prices, more than $200 at the two sales so far this week for local lambs. Still to come in the country, our research on what makes hens happy, but now to the war on waste. And if you take a look at horticulture and the big users of plastics, it would be hard to go past the berry industry. It's estimated the blueberry industry alone uses 50 million plus plastic punnets every year. But blueberry grower Natalie Bell from Mountain Blue Farms has told Kim Honan the industry is heading into new packaging options.
It's a lot of plastic, For us, it's concerning, and I think the industry as a whole is quite concerned by it and is working towards how we can, work with our customers as well to address this as a sort of industry as a whole.
And are you getting a lot of concern voiced by customers about your use of plastic?
No, and I think that I was at a thing with Coles the other day, public forum, and the general consensus is that there's a tolerance for single use, plastic where there is an actual really, a need. And so blueberries is something at this point of time that you can't put it in something else until we've sort of had the time to get it through our testing system and actually find the right thing that would last on the shelf, would basically last once you get home in the fridge, and then also can be disposed of in a biodegradable way.
You know, there is obviously pressure on the supermarkets to reduce the plastic packaging on fruit and veg, but do you see that this is achievable at a farm level?
Yeah, look, I think we all need to work together. I think the consumers are obviously driving this. We're seeing the demand and the need, and like obviously we're concerned as well, because we're also consumers just as much as, and we're users of the environment just as much as everyone else. So for us, we're all in it together, and I think the supermarkets are in it with us, and they're saying, bring us the options and we'll try and work with everyone. So they're out there. It's just a matter of really just trying to find and work through and do the testing. That's where I think if you spoke to majority of the industry, they're probably at a point where they're just testing things.
Do you have an idea, what it costs for recyclable packaging as opposed to, say, plastic packaging? Is it more expensive? Does it cost more for the farmer?
At this stage, I believe, and I've looked at sort of brief data, at this stage it does seem to be more expensive. I think one of the things is economies of scale, and the more we can get into things, the more we can use it, the more cost effective it will become. And so for us, that's when I said, not just our industry, but if we can work it as a collective agricultural industry, we'll have a much better thing of getting it to be cost effective for farmers and also cost effective for consumers.
Are there, recyclable punnets available, and can the punnets be recycled?
Look, it's not my area of expertise, but it's something we should be exploring all options.
Well, I certainly do put my punnets in the recycling bin, so I don't know where they end up.
One hopes that they're ending up there, yes. And we definitely feel, I think we've just got to keep exploring what are the options. Is it, punnets that are, are they, is the cardboard punnet or the, I've seen even a lot of those sugarcane punnets. Obviously, the more we use them, the more cost effective they're all going to come. The other thing that we are seeing in the industry, which I think, if we look at it holistically, is a really good thing, is that you're seeing a growth in larger packaging used by a lot more of the suppliers. And I think when you're talking that, you're talking about less packaging because, instead of buying four punnets, you're buying one punnet. And so that's also something that I think the industry is really committed to. And I think we're seeing that happen, that sort of that shift to that happening nationally and in its own sort of way as well.
So how soon do you think it'll be before the blueberry industry starts using plastic that isn't single use or find alternatives?
Look, I spoke to the sales team as I came out to meet you today, and they definitely said we'd like to be seeing something on the shelves within 12 months. We're already halfway through, and that's, we're doing this research already. It's not something that we're turning our back on. It's something that we see as a major driver to consumers, and we want to join the consumers in this space as well.
Blueberry grower Natalie Bell on the amount of plastic punnets used in the berry industry and the possible alternatives, talking there to Kim Honan. We'll look at research into the egg industry in just a moment.
Recognise an unsung hero in your community in this year's Australian Farmer of the Year Awards. We're looking for the best rural community leaders, the people who are going above and beyond to make their town a success. You can enter yourself or someone you know online at farmeroftheyear.com.au. The Australian Farmer of the Year Awards, proudly supported by Condinning Group and ABC Rural.
This is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe
on ABC Radio Hobart and across Tasmania.
And animal welfare is at the front and centre of the latest research and development priorities identified for the egg industry. There's a lot of public interest in the issue. In fact, 167,000 submissions were made to Animal Health Australia during a public consultation period to develop a national poultry standard and guidelines. Those standard and guidelines are due to be released later this year. Australian Eggs Managing Director Rowan McMonies says around $1 million has been earmarked for hen welfare research.
Our R&D is intended to be and is driven by egg farmers because we're an industry-owned RDC. And so for many years, we have focused on the key issues that were occurring on farm, mainly sort of production diseases or behavioural issues faced by hens. This is what has you know, essentially cause farmers to lose hens, and that's what they look to their RDC to say, can you help? Could you do some research to help us solve these very practical problems? And what we've done this year is look at the animal welfare issue more broadly, because there seems to be such an enormous public interest in animal welfare currently. And as an RDC, we want to support the industry and to support the process of resolving these problems with a view to ensuring industry sustainability. And the result has been we've ended up splitting the program. We will still be doing practical on-farm welfare research because it's important, mm-hmm. Critical even. But we also want to focus on new areas, and we've called that the Welfare Improvements Program. And we're looking to respond to what is a pretty clear message from the community that ongoing improvement is required across all of the facets of our industry, but importantly on animal welfare.
One of the projects that you'll be doing is looking at technologies to assess welfare and stress in a hen. How do you do that? How do you measure the positive and negative experiences of a chook?
Well, it's not easy, and it's why we're diving into this space. So the positive and negative experiences, or the effective state of hens, is really the key issue, if you like, in terms of animal welfare at the moment. There is a view out there by you know, a significant amount of people that it is not enough to only focus on whether hens are experiencing negative states or whether their biological function is being impeded in some way. There's a view that the positive effective states are important as well. And once that view is out there, the question is, how do you address it and how do you measure it? What we have is some groundbreaking and exciting research that started out really conducted in relation to humans, looking at microRNAs, which is a subset, if you like, of our DNA, with a view to determining biomarkers which have the potential to display positive and negative effective states. Now, it is by no means sure that this will be achieved, but we think it's a very exciting piece of research to invest in, because if it could bring clarity to the issue, then it could really move the whole animal welfare debate forward, because we'd have a lot more certainty and I guess, you know, facts, if you like, inserted into the process.
As to whether or not that chook was happy or not, basically.
I guess the word happy is so often used, but probably not the best term of reference, because it's such a humanised expression, if you like. But yeah.
But that is the problem that you're facing, isn't it? It's humanised expressions on animals, which seems to be a bigger problem to solve than a technology as to whether or not a hen is having a positive or a negative experience. There's a broader problem there, isn't there?
There certainly is. And when most people look at animal industries, livestock industries, they do tend to project what they would like their lives to be like onto what those animals would be like. As a research and development corporation, we can't really solve that. That's an aspect of human nature. What we're focusing on is, I guess, our role in the process and what we can do. And what we can do, I hope, is to do better, more relevant and groundbreaking science that can help to bring a lot more clarity. If this works, if microRNAs are a useful way to determine positive and negative effective states, there is the potential in the near future that we'll be having a much more relevant and fact-driven conversation about what the experience of hens are on farm.
Australian Eggs Managing Director Rowan McMoney speaking there to Joe Prendergast about research into the poultry industry. Time to check the latest on the weather. Deb Tabor joins us from the Bureau. G'day, Deb.
Hello, Tony. How are you?
Pretty good. Is it all settled down out there?
Oh, well, not if you're in the west of the state. Still a little bit showery, but for the rest, it's not too bad. We had a bit of a vicious little front move through yesterday, pushing some winds up quite high last night and some good rainfall. Particularly about the north and west, not much for the east and the southeast, unfortunately, but the highest falls up to 9 a.m. were in Cradle Valley, 34 millimetres, and Lake St Clair and Strathgordon, 32, Butler's Gorge, 31 millimetres, Mount Victoria, 29, then Yolla and Marrowa, 27, Sheffield around 28, and then since 9 a.m, we've had King William Creek being the highest on 9 millimetres, Misery Plateau, 8 millimetres, Mount Reed 4, Interlaken and Mount Barrow 3 millimetres.
I just love that name, Misery Plateau.
I know. It sounds a little bit gloomy, doesn't it? It's near Mount Field.
But is it an ironic name? Does your misery plateau out when you get there, or do you get more miserable? I don't know.
I'm not sure if I want to try.
No. Anyway, g'day to the people living there or near there.
That's right.
Yes. Yeah. Somebody takes the rainfall figures there, don't they?
Yes. Yep, they sure do.
Okay.
Or the rain gauge does. Yep.
We should talk to them one day. Deb, the outlook.
Okay, we've got a high over South Australia today, and that's directing a fresh westerly stream over us and bringing showers to the west, far south and Bass Strait Islands, but fine everywhere else. Snow to around 900 metres for the rest of today. For Thursday, the high moves eastwards and extends into the Tasman Sea, so showers will continue about the west, far south and Bass Strait Islands of Tasmania and mainly fine elsewhere. Just a slight chance of some very light showers late morning and afternoon. Snow to around 1,000 metres early on. On Friday, the stream will tend northwesterly early before a cold front crosses the state in the afternoon. So some showers about the west and far south, extending statewide for a period during the day. Then on Saturday, we'll see a colder west-to-southwesterly flow and some showers about the west, which will increase in the afternoon and extend to the north in the evening, but fine everywhere else. On Sunday, another cold front will cross early with a low to move to the south. So some showers, which will be more frequent about the west and north, and snow lowering to around 900 metres in the west late.
So we've still got a few warnings about.
Yes, we still do. So the minor flood warnings are current for the Meander, the North Esk, South Esk and the Macquarie Rivers. A strong wind warning is current for all Tasmanian coastal waters today, and a small craft wind alert for the southwest lakes. And for the wind warnings tomorrow will just be the strong wind warning for southern coastal waters from Tasman Island to Low Rocky Point.
Okay, a bit rough out there on the waters. What is the coastal waters and the swell telling us?
Okay, for the rest of today, yeah, we've got that westerly stream, a little bit rough, 15 to 25 knots, but rougher in the south where it's sitting on around 25 to 30 knots. Seas 2 to 3 metres. For tomorrow, westerly stream again of 15 to 25 knots, reaching 30 knots about the south. Then the winds will tend west to northwesterly in the evening and decrease to around 10 to 20 knots about the north. So seas of 1.5 to 2.5 metres, reaching 3 in the south. And at midday, the wave rider reported 6 metres with a maximum of 10 and a period around 13.5 seconds. At 9 a.m, Matsaika Island reported a westerly swell of 5 metres and Bruny Island a southwesterly of 2 metres. So for the rest of today and tomorrow in the west and south, you can expect a west to southwesterly swell near 5 metres, which will gradually become 3.5 metres late tomorrow. In the north, a westerly swell of 2 to 3 metres, decreasing to around 1 to 1.5 metres offshore tomorrow. And about the east, a southerly swell of 1 to 2 metres, reaching 3 metres in the south.
Gee, the wave rider getting a decent rise there, 5 to 10 metres. Wow.
Yeah, not as bad as what we had last week, but it is trying.
Mm. All right, Deb, thanks for that.
No worries. Thanks, Tony.
See you later. Deb Tabor from the Bureau at 21 minutes to 1. We'll visit a pork farm in the West Tamar in just a moment.
He told me the only person to change you is you. I listened.
Do you know a young person with a story to tell?
Eating disorder. A diagnosis. Deep down, something I'd longed for.
AWAR is looking for stories about what it's like growing up in regional Australia.
There are lots of dams where my family love to go swimming.
Winners get their story featured on the ABC and win an all-expenses-paid trip to the AWAR Regional Youth Summit in Canberra.
I met new people. I learnt new things.
Entries are open now. Go to abc.net.au/AWAR.
The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe
on ABC Radio Hobart and across Tasmania.
20 minutes to 1, brand new dairy opening up in the northwest of the state today. We'll take you there very shortly, and Richard Bailey will be along too with the latest on the lamb and cattle markets. Pretty good markets too. There comes a time in small business where expansion becomes a necessity. For the Stocker family at Langdale Farm, it meant shifting their pork small goods production out of the family kitchen and into a brand new processing room on their farm. Larissa Smith dropped into the West Tamar property to check things out.
It's a fairly typical brisk winter's day at Oliver and Fiona Stocker's farm at Glengarry. Their Wessex saddleback pigs, which they raise free range on this bush block, are preferring to shelter indoors. And that's where you'll find their owners too, inside their new processing room.
Tend to do belly bacon or streaky bacon slightly thicker,
and because it's more fatty, and it tends to come out really nice that way. And then the loins and the leg bacon, I make them slightly thinner.
Oliver is slicing up and packaging bacon to deliver to local providors this week.
And then I put the goes into a vacuum bag.
With this very clever looking device?
Yes, but it's such an amazing thing. We're just all over the place now. And when you suck all the air out, it lasts a lot longer. I put a month and a half on the sell by date. So it's just an amazing innovation for any kind of food, really. It's just... But it is a bit slower.
What are the labels on the back that you're putting on?
These are the new labels now, which shows that these are products of Australia, which have got to be on all food products these days. So it's 100% Australian. I use sugar, treacle, salt, which is all Australian made. So it's a 100% product of Australia. I was talking to somebody in the market last weekend, and they bought some bacon in the supermarket, and it was 27% Australian. So I don't know what that bit would be.
The colour of your bacon is so different to what you would buy in the supermarket. Can you explain that?
We don't use any nitrates, and butchers and most supermarkets, well, I think all supermarkets use nitrates, which kind of gives it a slight pink colour, which is what looks really nice, particularly in the butchers underneath the lights they use. But we don't use any of that, so to get a bit of a colour and mainly the flavour, I add a bit of treacle, darkens it up a little bit. And also with the smoking process, that darkens it up.
You've also been experimenting with your pork sausages as well. Is that your passion?
Well, funnily enough, bacon and sausages. Sausage primarily is why we actually started, because we found that when we moved to Australia, we just couldn't find any nice sausages. So once we moved down to here, and then we thought we'd get the pigs, that gave us a perfect opportunity to make some really nice English sausages. Well, we started out experimenting, but experimentation is kind of over now, and we do sausages where we include some of our own bacon in it. And that's coming out really well, and it's selling really well. And it just gives it a really nice extra bit of flavour. And we realised on the TV last night with Rick Stein that it's actually a French recipe, but we just stumbled upon it by accident.
How very English of you.
It is really, yes, that's right. Well, all the best things come by accidents, don't they?
How long did it take you to get this processing room up and running?
The process was quite drawn out. The actual building wasn't too bad, but I had sort of a few issues with towards the end, we were getting the final permits ticked off and that kind of thing. So I had it completely finished, but out of action, because I wasn't allowed to use it for several months, really. And then the person who was going to do some drawing, he decided to go on holiday for a month, so that slowed it down as well. So I've only recently actually got the final ticket for it, which is fantastic. But I'm a cabinet maker by trade, so I did all the work except the plumbing and a small amount of the electrics.
So stainless steel benches?
Yes, benches all second-hand, sinks from eBay. Just everything was as the cheapest I could do it, really, to make it viable. Because it's only a small business, and to go the whole hog and buy everything new and from whiz-bang shops, it just would have blown it out of the water, really. So, but doing everything myself, getting everything second-hand as much as I could, like I'm welding up all the legs for the stainless steel bench tops and all that kind of stuff, it just, kept the price down as much as possible.
How important is it to the business to have complete control over what you do here, from raising the pigs to processing them to marketing them?
I find it incredibly important, actually, because from birth to the processing time, I can gauge how much fat they're going to have. And then from the butchers, I can get them to cut it exactly how I want it most of the time when they listen to what I say.
But yeah, take us back to that fat content. I'm curious how you can determine if a pig is gaining fat and not necessarily meat.
It's all done, kind of goes down to a body score, which is like number one is when they're very thin and you can see all their bones. And then it goes to, I think it's number five or six, where the fat content, they become very round and you can actually see, you can't see or feel any of the bones, which is they're much too fat. And it's just kind of gauging in that kind of bracket, just really by look, because you can't really feel it. Because I've had pigs before and I think, oh, I don't feel very fat. And you get them back and they're really fat. And I think when they're too fat, the fat becomes quite tight, so it feels like it's meat, but it's actually fat. And that, again, it depends on what you feed them as well, obviously. We went for a phase at the beginning where we were getting feta, which is a great food, and it was free, and they loved it, but they just put on fat, so we had to stop. It was just hopeless. What I tend to do now is I feed them as much as I can in the first sort of 5 or 6 months, and then I slim them down at the end, because I want them to grow as quickly as possible, but I don't want them to be fat. So the younger ones I have now would be quite fat, but when I slim them down towards the end of their time, then that fat becomes meat.
Where would you like to take the business in the next 5 years?
I have looked into the idea of making prosciutto, but the laws as they stand in this country would be just impossible. It'd just be vastly expensive.
Why is that?
Well, the council as well, they have very strict regulations, and meat in between the temperatures of 4 degrees and 60 degrees is what they count as a danger period where bacteria can grow. And that's that kind of regulation. They kind of follow through no matter what the meat is or what stage it's at. Like with the bacon, when it's in the smoker, I have to keep that above 60. And with the prosciutto, you basically brine it or have it in salt to start with, and then you hang it outside, and that's about it, really. So it's right smack in the middle of there, what they call a danger zone. So you need to have incredibly strict regulations. And likewise with salami, there's only a very few people who make salami, because each batch has to be tested by the DPI at a cost, which is quite expensive. So you have to be doing very large quantities to make it work. And in our scale, we just can't do that. But we did. It would have been really nice to be able to make prosciutto in a very small quantities, just to be able to sell a little bit, just for novelty value, really, making our own. We're making our own, but we're just not allowed to sell it.
How much time are you spending in here?
Well, since I stopped using the domestic kitchen, quite a lot less time than I would in there, because I can do it so much quicker, and also I can be in here all day. Whereas using our domestic kitchen, I had to finish at 3 o'clock when the kids came home from school, and I couldn't start until they'd gone to school, and so all of that kind of thing. So now I can just do in here. But we only process once a fortnight, because that's when we process the pigs, and we do the harvest market once a fortnight as well. I don't spend a vast amount. I'd spend sort of maybe 3-4 days in here this week. I mean, next week I'll only be in here a few hours here and there. So it's most of the time it's just sitting here. It's just very nice to have it here.
Oliver Stocker from Langdale Farm at Glengarry in the state's northeast, chatting to Larissa Smith inside their new pork processing room. We'll go from pork to the lamb and cattle markets with Richard Bailey in just a moment.
St Helens, Triple J's One Night Stand is coming for you. On Saturday, September 1st, we're bringing the party to St Helens, Tasmania. Peking Duck, Vance Joy, Middle Kids, TK Meidzer and Alex the Astronaut are coming with us for this epic free all-ages party. If you live in St Helens, this will be the best day ever. If you can't make it, we'll be bringing it to you live.
Triple J's One Night Stand!
On ABC Radio Hobart and across Tasmania,
this is Tony Briscoe.
Let's head out to the livestock markets and say good day to Richard Bailey. How are you, Richard?
Very well, Tony. Going well.
Excellent. We might turn it around this week and start with the lamb market. And I want you to have a listen to a story we just had on. Animal protein analyst with Rabobank, Angus Gidley-Baird, talking about the US market for lamb. Have a listen to this, Richard.
It depends on the margins through the supply chain, but looking at, say, a US import price going into, well, Australian product going into the US, they're importing product about $18 a kilo. We're selling lambs at $7 a kilo, so there's a bit of margin that's grown out in the last year and a half in that market. So despite us getting some really good prices, you know, the US market is still performing very strongly.
Yeah, and lamb consumption in the US has doubled in the past 7 years.
Yeah, very much so. Just let's clarify a couple of things. One is you can't talk about selling into the States at $18 a kilo and it costing $7 a kilo here. It's $7 in the sale yards. So they've got to get it cooled and get it processed and get it to America. So that needs to be sharpened up. I mean, but it's good news is that you would think from what he's just said that the exporters probably have got a bit of room to play with any luck. I think the other thing is that, and we can talk about this at another time, but I think the massive increase in the volume going into the places like China are the other really good news stories. It flowed through pretty well on yesterday, though. We had a very, very, very strong lamb sale at both Kilafati and Parana. We saw $200 topped. I think probably that has happened before, but it's a while since that's happened. Our extra heavy lambs made anywhere from $166 to $204. A lot of those averages of those extra heavy lambs in the 190s. Heavy lambs, $155 to $167. Trade lambs, anywhere from $130 to $156. Now, all these lambs, these trade lambs and heavy and extra heavy lambs, are all somewhere between $10 and $20 higher than last week, so that's a very good sign. And then when we got into the lighter lambs, I thought they were just a tad cheaper in places, particularly the export light lambs. They made down to $79, but mainly $95 to $110. Restockers in the market sort of $70 to $122. And feeders bought sort of fresher and more forward lambs anywhere from $125 to $140 a head. So following on from that previous story, it's the way it's going at the moment. Over in the mutton yard, few less sheep. In fact, almost half the number of sheep. This market was a bit cheaper. That follows interstate trends. I think also there's probably a bit of an impact. I think I'm right in saying that over the last 10 days, I think we've only shipped on about three of those days. In other words, from Devonport or Burnie into Melbourne. So although the interstate exporters were in the market, they probably weren't quite as eager to get too many hanging around them as in previous weeks. And so a lot of the sheep were somewhere around about $10 cheaper. Heavy sheep made $114 to $128. Medium weights $89 to $119. And light sheep $82 to $106. Some very light sheep $46 to $60 a head. So very good day in the lamb market anyway.
Richard, as we head out of winter into spring, what do you think will happen with the lamb market? You think those prices will sustain and keep going up, or is there a point?
There's a point, but we did say that almost a month ago. look, there will be a point. It'll just be interesting to see what, no matter what the actual numbers are, there's always a bit of a peak at this time of the year before the new season's lambs come along out of northern Victoria and southern New South Wales. The indication is that's going to be later than normal. It'll be a matter of where it comes back to, by the middle of spring. In the last 2 or 3 years, it's sort of come back and settled around that 5 to 530 or 40 cents. Now, it'll be interesting to see this year. Maybe it'll come back and only sort of, it'll settle around 600 cents, which I think would be pretty pleasing to most producers. But that'll be something we'll soon find out. We're starting to see a few new seasons lambs floating into Bendigo, Ballarat, Wagga. So in the next month, we'll get a bit of a guide as to what's going to happen there. But just going back to the bloke from Rabobank, his indication is that the Americans can pay X. So you would think that, there's a good chance that money will keep going. So interesting times.
Okay, the cattle market.
Cattle market was pretty good too. Just about everything went up around about 10 to 20 cents a kilo. There were similar numbers to last week, but still very small numbers. But it meant that we saw yearlings make over 300 cents yesterday, and a few of them for the first time for a while, which was good news. Most yearling steers made 292 to 310 cents. Heifers, 270 to 306. Feeders paid 270 to 286 for heifers, and restockers paid 276 to 285 for yearling steers. There weren't any bullocks or grown steers. A couple of heavy heifers, one topped at $1,924 a head, up to 260 cents, which is pretty good. And there were just a fewer number of cows, or 25 yarded. Just about all of them were heavy beef cows. This market was close to 20 cents better, 230 to 248 cents, averaging 241 cents a kilo. It meant that a lot of these big heavy cows, they made anywhere from $1,345 and topped at $1,972. Now, that was a very, very heavy cow. The cow market is interesting because it's been going up each week probably for about the last month, I suppose. And a lot of that goes into the States as well. So things looking pretty good like that. And, from what my understanding around the state, apart from a couple of pockets on the East Coast, the season's looking okay. So interesting times ahead, Tony.
Okay, anything else for us?
No, I don't think so.
Talk to you Friday.
All right.
Richard Bailey, more on the livestock markets in Friday's edition of the Country Hour. Well, a short time ago at Woolnorth in the northwest, Chinese-owned dairy company Moonlake opened a new $2.7 million dairy. Our northwest reporter, Margot Kelly, was at the launch. G'day, Margot.
G'day, Tony.
How's the weather first up?
Quite different to yesterday. While everyone was battening down the hatches with severe weather warnings yesterday, today there is blue sky, but an awful lot of water on the ground still to wade through.
Okay, interesting name for this new dairy called Gums Dairy. What can you tell us about it?
So it's a brand new dairy, quite a strange experience for all of us to walk into a sparkling brand new dairy that smells rather like sausage sizzle instead of the usual scent that you get when you go to a dairy. It's an upgrade. So it's basically on that one dairy operation. There are 25 dairy operations that Moonlake own in that northwest tip of the state. They've built this new 60-bale rotary dairy to milk cows to replace an outdated one that they did have elsewhere on that farm. It's got all the new technology to try to make it as efficient as possible. So that farm is milking at the moment 1,100 cows. It will be milking 1,250. And I spoke to the farm manager. She said they should be able to handle that milking operation with just one labour unit in the sheds when it's all up and running.
Did they tell you who made up the name? Was it gum trees on the property?
There's a few gums around, Tony, but unfortunately I didn't get to the bottom of that one for you.
Okay, what about Managing Director of Moonlake, Sean Shuey? He was expected to be at Woolnorth for the official opening. That didn't happen.
That's right, Tony. We did expect Sean Shuey would be there and that we could ask some questions about the rather turbulent first half of the year that Moonlake Investments saw. He wasn't there, and the CFO and acting general manager were, but they declined to comment about the structure of the business.
So no news at this stage of the future management of the company?
That's right. So the backdrop is that it's pretty much throw to the day news that all five non-executive directors of Moonlake Investments and the CEO resigned en masse, citing concerns around funding. Since then, we haven't had any word on how the restructure of the business is going to try to add liquidity or who will step into those roles at the moment. But the Moonlake is pointing to this investment of $2.7 million into a new dairy as evidence that there is cash flowing, but it's only really a drop in the ocean compared to the promised $100 million worth of investment that Moonlake gave to the Foreign Investment Review Board when buying the farm, and the promised 95 new jobs. So we haven't had an update on where that $100 million is yet or when it may hit the ground.
Okay, Margot, thank you for that. We'll leave it there. Margot Kelly from Woolnorth. Now, in tomorrow's edition of the Country Hour, we'll talk about the exports of Australian wine and how the exports have grown. Here's Sherilee Davies with a preview.
Some 5% of Tasmania's wine is sold into international markets, so it is a slightly different story, I guess, to the rest of the country. What is important is that the value of our wine exports, our Tasmanian wine exports, is growing very, very strongly. And that really for us is more important than purely growing volume of wine that we're selling in the export market.
More on that with Sherilee Davies from Wine Industry Tasmania on tomorrow's edition of the Country Hour.